Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. Remember to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. Now, here's our pastor and teacher, Jim McLarty.
All right, we are in Ezekiel 41 tonight. At least that's where we're starting. Ezekiel 41 and 42 are both made up of just more measurements, more descriptions of the temple. How many of you remembered to bring the picture I gave you last week? The visual aid of the picture helps so that when you're hearing the description, you can kind of plug in all of the stuff that you're hearing. But what I'm going to do tonight is just kind of synopsize chapter 41 and chapter 42, because chapter 43 is really the essence of all of this description of the temple, because in chapter 43, God actually occupies that temple. And it is directly in contrast with how God left Solomon's temple, how he abandoned the temple, and then all of the bad stuff happened to Israel. So the very fact that there is a vision of God occupying some future temple that hasn't been built yet, hasn't been established yet, and here is God promising not only to have it built some point in the future, but that he's also going to occupy it, is a sure and definite guarantee that God is going to do all the stuff he ever said he's going to do for Israel. And that is controversial in some circles, certainly for folks who say that the church is Israel. It's very difficult to deal with these chapters and somehow allegorize them to make them out to be the church. But chapter 41 and chapter 42, and especially 43, is a chapter that people do use in order to argue that Ezekiel's temple is some kind of allegorical representation of the church. So we're going to look at that tonight too. But when you look at the direct parallel of God abandoning Israel, of God abandoning the temple, of God punishing Israel, this is like the third car I've seen pull in since I've started talking. I really ought to just keep introducing, and we're going to fill this room. So.
Isn't that what you generally do? Just keep.
Oh, nice. Nice. As I was saying, we're going to look at not only how people have abused, in particular chapter 43, in order to say that Israel and the church are one and that the references to Israel in Ezekiel actually mean the church. But we're also going to look tonight at the contrast and the similarities between God abandoning his temple and God establishing the temple. Now, real important principle. Chapter 41 and 42, not so much 43, definitely. We're going to see what we saw in chapter 40, which is God reestablishing animal sacrifice. This causes a great deal of consternation for people. How can God possibly be reestablishing animal sacrifice? He doesn't tell us. Through the book of Ezekiel, nowhere does God say, "And I'm reestablishing animal sacrifice because." So we have to kind of speculate a bit. Last week I said, and I think it's a fair conclusion, that God determined the kind of worship that he not just requested, but requires. He requires a type of worship out of these particular people. This nation, these genetic people, have been chosen out of all the nations on the earth in order to worship God in this particular way. Which is why all the way back at Mount Sinai, when God spoke to Moses, he gave him very specific instruction, not only about how to build the tabernacle in the wilderness, but he gave him all the dimensions. He told him how to make the hooks that the curtains were going to be on. He told him every stick of furniture that was going to be inside there, how it was going to be built, what it was going to be made out of, how the high priest was going to approach him, when the high priest could approach him, what he had to be wearing down to his underwear. God is very, very specific in saying to Israel, you will approach me this way. I will be worshiped. I will be honored. I will be glorified in you people. But then he wasn't. And Israel rebelled. And Israel chased after foreign gods. And Israel didn't keep God's Sabbaths. And Israel did start bringing faulty animals and animals with spots and blemish, animals that weren't any good for mating. They were starting to sacrifice those to God instead of sacrificing the best of what they had. And so the worship that God required was never actually fully accomplished in Israel. Now, that's all part of God's divine plan. God sovereignly designed it that way so that we could see that human beings, even with all of this instruction, all this specificity from God, human beings still could not accomplish perfect worship toward God. The sinful nature of human beings just didn't allow it. But that is why it is so important that the Bible keeps talking about a future kingdom that belongs to Israel, and that the future regathering of all 12 tribes is going to be ruled over by Christ himself, David's greater son, in keeping with the Davidic covenant. And as a consequence, finally, God's worship that he requires is actually going to take place in this temple that hasn't been built yet. So, is it okay with you for God to say, this is how I'm worshiped? Is it okay with you that he says that? Because there are a whole lot of people who have a problem with that. There are a whole lot of people who say, but we can't have animal worship. That can't happen. Because all the animals in the Old Testament all pointed to Christ. And now Christ has come, and Christ is the final sacrifice. And haven't you read the book of Hebrews, Jim? Because all those animals that could never take away sin, they all just cast the shadow that Christ is the fulfillment of. He's the one that cast the shadow. So there can't be any more animal sacrifice. The best argument I can give you for future animal sacrifice in Ezekiel's temple is God said so. That's the best argument there is. God said it. And if you're going to read these next couple of chapters and conclude that it can't mean that, then you have to do two things. Number one, you have to tell us what it does mean based on what it says. You're not allowed to import any extra words. You're not allowed to say, well, what it means allegorically. You've got to explain how these words that demand animal sacrifice mean no animal sacrifice. You got to explain that. And secondly, at that point, you become the arbiter of the Word of God. You're the person who gets to tell us what is and is not legitimate in the Word of God. And I like you, I love you, but you just simply aren't that smart. You don't have that kind of authority. You don't have the right to go through God's Bible with an eraser and say, well, this part doesn't count. So my expectation in a very literal manner is that God plans for there to be a temple which hasn't been built yet, and there is going to be animal sacrifice in that temple, and Israel's worship of God, which has always been very defined and very definite but never accomplished, is one day going to be accomplished the way that God requires. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Why? Because we're dealing with a perfect God. We're dealing with a God who says, this is going to happen, and it's going to happen. And if God cannot demand this kind of worship in this kind of temple, if he can't be this specific, then you really don't have any grounds to believe that when he told you he was going to save you fully and completely through the sacrifice of Christ, maybe he just wasn't being specific. Maybe he just didn't mean it. Maybe you're going to get to heaven someday and he's going to go, did you think I meant that? Oh, Gabriel, I got him. No, the truth of the matter is God is very specific, which is why he can say, this is how you approach me. You approach me, Israel, you approach me through the temple system, through the priests, through the sacrifices. Those who are in my son, who I gave my son before the foundation of the world, those people approach me via my son. And it's just that specific. And so my argument again is, if you argue that Ezekiel is not being specific and that it means something else, then where does that finish? Where does that end? At what point can you say, well, now this part's true. When it's talking about me, when it's talking about my salvation, that's all valid. But when it's talking about Israel, you know, God didn't mean that. He didn't. I say he means every single word. We okay with that?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, I'm done introducing. Let me just summarize chapter 41 for a moment. Because at this point, Ezekiel is led to the first portico, or the entrance of the temple. And there's a porch-like vestibule on the front of the temple, and there's a flight of stairs that leads up to the portico, and there are pillars on each side of the door jambs. Ezekiel climbed the stairs, and he entered through the vestibule into the outer sanctuary. That's the beginning of chapter 41. As he enters the building, each gate or doorway is narrower than the one before it. So as you progress toward the sanctuary and toward the holiest place, the pathway becomes narrower and narrower, and each successive doorway becomes more narrow as you reach the holy place where God is. So surrounding the temple, there are three levels of side rooms, one above another. There's 30 on each level. So these rooms are probably just storerooms. Nobody knows what they're for. Ezekiel doesn't tell us what they're for. But they are rooms that are similar to those that are in Solomon's temple. If you go back to 1 Kings 6 and you read 1 Kings 6, 5 to 10, you'll find similar rooms. Apparently, they're for storage for the priests. Starting at about verse 12 of chapter 41, Ezekiel records the overall dimensions of the temple proper. And he describes its decorations and its furnishings. Immediately west of the temple, there's a structure that's described as the building facing the temple courtyard on the west side. You'll recall last week that there is no gate on the west side. The primary gate is on the east side. If you come in the eastern gate and keep walking, you're going to walk straight into the front of the sanctuary and then to the Holy of Holies. But behind the temple to the west, there's no gate there. There's a gate to the north and the south and the east. Ezekiel then records the overall dimensions of the temple, but it's really not explained what the function of this building is that's to the west side, that's behind the temple. It just simply exists. The temple is 87 and a half feet wide and about 175 feet or 100 cubits long. There's carved cherubim and palm trees that are etched into the wood that covered the interior of the building. And these palm trees and these angelic creatures, these cherubim, are also just like in Solomon's temple. You can go to 1 Kings 6:29 and read about them. The only piece of furniture that you're going to find in the temple proper is described as a wooden altar that's 3 cubits high, which would be about 5 1/4 feet, 2 cubits square, that's 3 1/4 feet, and it's called the table that is before the Lord. So let's read chapter 41. Now you know what you're looking at. Then he brought me to the nave, or the entrance area, the portico, and he measured the side pillars. 6 cubits wide on each side was the width of the side pillar. And the width of the entrance was 10 cubits, and the sides of the entrance was 5 cubits on each side. And he measured the length of the nave. It is 40 cubits, and the width 20 cubits. Then he went inside and measured each side pillar of the doorway, 2 cubits, and the doorway 6 cubits high, and the width of the doorway 7 cubits. And he measured its length, 20 cubits, and its width, 20 cubits, before the nave. And he said to me, "This is the most holy place." Then he measured the wall of the temple, 6 cubits, and the width of the side chamber, 4 cubits, all around the house on every side. And the side chambers were in 3 stories, one above the other, and 30 were in each story. And the side chambers extended to the wall, which stood on the inward side all around, that they might be fastened and not be fastened to the wall of the temple itself. So it's attached to the wall rather than being attached to the temple. The side chambers surrounding the temple were wider at each successive story because the structure surrounding the temple went upward by stages on all sides of the temple. Therefore, the width of the temple increased as it went higher. And thus, one went from the lowest story to the highest by way of the second story. I saw also that the house had a raised platform all around. The foundation of the side chambers were a full rod of 6 cubits in height. The thickness of the outer wall and the side chambers was 5 cubits, but the free space between the side chambers belonging to the temple and the outer chambers was 20 cubits on every side, all around the temple on every side. And the doorways of the side chambers toward the free space consisted of one doorway toward the north and another doorway toward the south, and the width of the free space was 5 cubits all around. Is anybody bored yet? I just want you to see how specific it is. Because by the time you get to chapter 43, God's going to say, now tell Israel, this is how I want it. This is exactly how to do it. Notice how specific God's being. God is not leaving it, important principle, God is not leaving it up to the people to decide for themselves how they're going to worship or approach God. God is being very specific to Israel that they are going to build this exact structure because that's what God requires of them. Now, I can keep reading. I can read about thresholds, and I can read about measuring lengths, and I can read about the ground and the entrance, verse 20, from the ground to above the entrance, there were cherubim and palm trees that were carved, as well as the wall of the nave. And the doorpost of the nave was square. And as for the front of the sanctuary, the appearance of one doorpost was like that of another. Just notice how specific it is. That's all I want you to get for the moment. And go to chapter 42. Because leaving the temple proper, Ezekiel then describes several adjacent structures that are for use by the priests. This complex of rooms was connected to the inner court with entrances from the outer court. There were 2 buildings on the north side with a common corridor that's 10 cubits long. There's a row of rooms next to the outer court. That's 50 cubits long. And then there's another row of rooms next to the sanctuary that was twice as long, 100 cubits. And these rooms were 3 stories high, with all of the rooms on the third level being narrower than those that were on the first or the second floor. And an identical group of rooms was on the temple's south side. And in those rooms, the priests who approached the Lord would eat their most holy offerings, and they would store their garments. And according to the Mosaic law, the priests would receive a portion of some of the offerings that's continued here, and they're going to eat those holy offerings in these rooms. So a similar provision's being made in this temple as what was made all the way back to Moses. And then there's the outer walls of the temple. After the angel measured everything within the temple complex, he led Ezekiel outside to record the external dimensions of the temple. The complex is a square measuring 500 cubits or 875 feet per side. The total area occupied by the temple is 765,625 square feet. Yes, we did the math. Enough square footage, for those of you who are trying to imagine that, enough square footage that you can fit 13 football fields. So you can play your whole season in one day. So that's good. Okay, so that's chapter 42. What I just summarized for you is everything in chapter 42. Because I'm trying to get us to chapter 43, because that's where the really dramatic stuff takes place. After the very perfect and very exacting description of what the temple is going to look like, all its dimensions, all of its rooms, where the priests are going to be, where the storage is going to be, how thick the walls are going to be, after this massive thing is described, which, I say again, has never been built in human history. It doesn't exist. And so we have to say, God is going to have this temple, or we have to say, well, the Bible's wrong. You know, the Bible meant, God meant for this to get built when he delivers the Israelites out of Babylon after the Medo-Persians take over and Cyrus allows them to go back and build the temple. God intended for them to build this, but they didn't. They just fixed the walls and fixed up the old temple, and oh well, God loses. God wanted this temple, but he didn't get that. Or we have to say, an absolutely sovereign God who's completely in control is saying someday this temple is going to exist, specifically because when it exists, Jesus is ruling from Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. So unless you can find Christ in Jerusalem, you don't have to find this temple yet. But this temple has to exist in human history, future to us, or else let's close our Bibles and go home, because it's all wrong. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. Go back to chapter 10. I know we finally got to chapter 43, but we're going to take a little side trip first. Go back to chapter 10 of Ezekiel. This is Ezekiel's vision of the Spirit of God leaving Solomon's temple. And you're going to notice that the language is identical to the vision that he saw at the beginning of the book at the River Chebar, when he saw the angelic creatures with the four faces, when he saw the throne of God and the emerald rainbow. When he saw all of that at the beginning, he describes it again in verse 10. And when we get to verse 43, he's going to say that he saw the glory of Israel coming from the east, and that his appearance was like the vision that I saw, like the vision which I saw when he came to destroy the city, and like the visions that I saw by the river Chebar. And I fell on my face. So there's a consistency here. I want you to see the continuity of God. Every time he appears to Ezekiel, he appears in the same imagery. He's moving on a throne that is on a chariot that's being carted by the wings of the cherubim who have the four faces, and the cherubim only go one direction at a time, and they all move in unison. It's a magnificent description of the God of ages coming to present himself to Ezekiel. So first we have to see him leave the temple, because in chapter 43, he's going to occupy his temple. And that's a magnificent thing. The God of glory occupying the place that he says, my name is here. This is where my worship is. Okay, so starting in chapter 10, verse 1. Then I looked and behold, in the expanse that was over the heads of the cherubim, something like a sapphire stone in appearance, resembling a throne, appeared above them. A throne made of sapphire stones. That's pretty magnificent. Mm-hmm. Anybody seen one of those lately? I've been to England, by the way. Anybody here ever been to England? I've been to the Tower of London. I've seen the crown jewels. They were pretty impressive. They were on display. They were pretty impressive. Yeah. A throne made out of sapphire stone makes the crown jewels look like a booger. Okay? So that's all I'm saying. That's all I'm getting at.
Like a booger.
Like a booger. That's what it makes it look like. And he spoke to the man that was clothed in linen, and he said, enter between the whirling wheels under the cherubim and fill your hands with the coals of fire from between the cherubim and scatter them over the city. And he entered in my sight. Then the cherubim were standing on the right side of the temple when the man entered, and the cloud filled the inner court. And then the glory of the Lord went up from the cherub to the threshold of the temple. He's going from the inner court out toward the threshold of the temple. And the temple was filled with the cloud. And the court was filled with the brightness and the glory of God. And moreover, the sound of the wings of the cherubim was heard as far as the outer court, like the voice of God Almighty when he speaks. And it came about when he commanded the man clothed in linen, saying, take fire from between the whirling wheels, from between the cherubim. He entered and he stood beside a wheel. And then the cherub stretched out his hand from between the cherubim to the fire that was between the cherubim. And he took some and he put it into the hands of the one clothed in linen who took it, and he went out. And the instruction, of course, is take this out and scatter it over the city. It's a sign of judgment over the city. It's a sign that God is going to start destroying Jerusalem. The cherubim appeared to have the form of man's hands under their wings. And then I looked, and behold, four wheels beside the cherubim, one wheel beside each cherubim. And the appearance of the wheels was like the gleam of a Tarshish stone. And as for their appearance, all four of them had the same likeness, as if one wheel were within another wheel. Does anybody understand what that means? Because if you do understand that perfectly, then I'm going to have you explain the Trinity to me. Anybody up for this? No. Sandy, you got anything? No. Okay, good. Just checking. By the way, everybody, Sandy, Kyla, Bob. Verse 9, I looked and behold, four wheels beside the cherubim, one wheel beside each cherub. And the appearance of the wheels was like the gleam of a Tarshish stone. And as for the appearance, all four of them had the same appearance, as if one wheel were within another wheel. When they moved, they went in any of four directions without turning as they went. But they followed in the direction which they faced without turning as they went. And their whole body, their backs, their hands, their wings, and the wheels were full of eyes all around, and the wheels belonging to all four of them. The wheels were called in my hearing the whirling wheels, and each of them had four faces. And the first one was like the face of a cherub, and the second face like the face of a man, and the third was like the face of a lion, and the fourth face like the face of an eagle. Then the cherubim rose up. They are the living beings that I saw by the river Chebar. Now, when the cherubim moved, the wheels would go beside them. And also when the cherubim lifted up their wings to rise from the ground, the wings would not turn from beside them. And when the cherubim stood still, the wheels would stand still. And when they rose up, the wheels would rise up with them, and the spirit of the living beings was in them. Then the glory of the Lord departed from the threshold of the temple and stood over the cherubim. When the cherubim departed, they lifted their wings and rose up from the earth in my sight with the wheels beside them, and they stood still at the entrance of the east gate of the Lord's house. And the glory of God of Israel hovered over them. These are the living beings that I saw beneath the God of Israel by the river Chebar, so I knew that they were cherubim. Each one had four faces, and each one four wings, and beneath their wings was the form of human hands. And for the likeness of their faces, they had the same faces whose appearance I had seen by the river Chebar. Each one went straight forward. So the Spirit of God has left the Temple of Solomon, and coals are being poured out over Jerusalem. God has abandoned his temple because the Israelites had abandoned God. Because the Israelites were chasing after foreign gods, not keeping his Sabbath, were committing all kinds of adulterous works, which God calls them adulterous works. They were committing all kinds of sin and rebellion against him. And so God, in response, abandons the temple. There can't be any more worship for God. Now, from historically speaking, from that point, you don't see God in his spirit re-enter the temple. That temple is destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar and his armies. It is rebuilt during the time of Nehemiah. It is rebuilt during the time of Ezra, but at that time, there's no Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant has already been taken out of the holiest place. The holy objects have been taken away. There's all kinds of speculation where they went or who took them, but to this day, no one has found them short of Steven Spielberg. No one's found them so far, and so the importance of chapter 43 of Ezekiel, and you can turn there now, is that this is the image of God coming back to his temple. This is God filling his temple again. This is God reestablishing his worship in his temple. Now, in between the Solomonic temple and whatever temple is going to be built or rebuilt during the tribulation period, Antichrist is going to stand in it, showing himself that he is God. That's not this temple. In between there, there have been like Herod's temple. Herod was an Edomian. He wasn't even a Jew. He was a puppet vassal king that was imposed on Israel by the Romans, which is why he was so hated. And so in order to curry favor with the Jews, he built them a temple. And that's what we know as Herod's temple. But again, there was no Ark of the Covenant in Herod's temple. And as long as there's no Ark of the Covenant, if there's no holy objects, then the worship that God prescribed to Moses can't take place. And so they just kind of did their best. They just kind of did what they could do and convinced themselves that they were actually worshiping God the way that God required, but they never actually were. Here in chapter 43, God is going to occupy, for the first time since he left Solomon's temple, he's going to occupy his temple again. The glory of God returns to Israel. And I know I'm yelling that, but the glory of God returns to Israel. I don't know how many more times I can say that. The glory of God returns to Israel, to the worship of Israel. How many times in the book of Ezekiel now? It's a test. How many times now in the book of Ezekiel have we read God promising the restoration of Israel? It just keeps happening and happening and happening. Every time, consistently, all the way through the Old Testament, that any prophet says God is going to send you out of your land, God's going to destroy the temple, God's going to do all that, invariably, every single time, they speak with one voice and say, and God's going to restore you. And he's going to bring you back again. And he's going to give you the temple. And God is going to be your God, and you are going to be his people. Which is exactly why after Jesus' death and burial and resurrection, after speaking for 40 days about the kingdom with his disciples before he sailed off in the blue, the very last question they asked him, are you going to restore the kingdom to Israel at this time? The hope of Israel for a restored kingdom didn't change just because Jesus came. In fact, it got stronger because now Messiah is here. Now we know who the king is. That's why when he rode into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey that no one had ever ridden before, that's why they threw their clothes and palm branches in the street and they cried, Hosanna to the Son of David, because they saw him as the fulfillment of the Davidic covenant. All of our kingdom promises are coming true. Then he died. And then he raised again. And now they're thinking, well, you're the best king ever. They can't kill you. And you give us bread. And you give us fish. And you do miracles. And everybody's going to be well. You're the best king ever. You can see why they would ask, so now? Now? You're going to restore the kingdom now? And his answer to them was, it's not for you to know the times and the seasons that God has placed in his own hand. And then he sailed off into the blue. Why? Well, according to Paul, it's so that you could be saved. So that God could turn his attention to the Gentiles until he's brought in the full number of the Gentiles. And then Paul concludes in Romans 11, and then all Israel will be saved. So if God hadn't planned it this way and accomplished it exactly this way, there was no hope for you. If Jesus had established the kingdom right then fine, Israel got their kingdom. What does that mean to Tom? Tom's a Gentile. He's outside the commonwealth of Israel. He doesn't know Israel's Messiah. So, according to Paul and Paul's theology, God at this point is bringing Gentiles by grace, without the law, without the activity of the temple, without the high priest. God is bringing Gentiles in order to make Israel jealous. And then when their jealousy has come to the full, Christ returns. They look on him whom they have pierced and weep like a mother weeps over her only child. And then he establishes the kingdom. And part of that kingdom is this temple. And when this temple is built, God occupies it. I just want you to see how important that is. That's really vital. Okay, chapter 43. All of that completely up until this point was technically all introduction. So you know the rule. Do you know the rule? You know the rule. Do they know the rule? Kyla, what's the rule? All right, chapter 43, starting at verse 1. Then he led me to the gate facing toward the east. That's why I said it's the primary gate. As you come through that gate, you go through a succession of ever stricter walls, more narrow doorways until you go into the holy place. So God is coming from the east. Behold, the glory of the God of Israel was coming from the way of the east, and his voice was like the sound of many waters, and the earth shone with his glory. And it was like the appearance of the vision which I saw, like the vision which I saw when he came to destroy the city. That's what we read in chapter 10. And the visions were like the vision which I saw by the river Chebar. That's the beginning of Ezekiel. And I fell on my face. Good reaction. And the glory of the Lord came into the house by the way of the gate facing toward the east. And the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court. And behold, the glory of the Lord filled the house. Then I heard one speaking to me from the house while a man was standing beside me. And he said to me, "Son of man, this is the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet, where I will dwell among the sons of Israel forever." Okay, does the eternally existing one understand eternality well enough to be able to say forever and mean forever?
Yes.
There he is saying, "I'm going to dwell with the sons of Israel forever." Now, you can't say that's the church. There's no way to make that the church, because it has to be those people who were originally abandoned. It has to be those people who were originally scattered. In what way was the church ever scattered? In what way has the church ever rebelled against their Savior? In what way can you make a one-for-one equivalency between Israel and the church here? You just can't. And here's God saying, "The soles of my feet belong here. This is the place of my throne, where I'm going to stand, where I'm going to sit, where I will dwell among the sons of Israel forever. And the sons of Israel will not again defile my holy name." Where did the church defile God's holy name? Where's that? It's not recorded anywhere in the Bible. "Neither their kings." Okay, when did the church ever have a king outside of Christ? But this is plural. They're kings. Israel had kings who defiled Israel, who led them into foreign worship and the worship of idols. That's exactly Israel's history. "The house of Israel will not again defile my holy name, neither they nor their kings, by their harlotry and by the corpses of their kings when they die, by setting their threshold by my threshold, and their doorpost beside my doorpost." What is God saying here in verse 8? He's saying, "I'm not like you, and you're not like me. I'm separate. I'm holy." So much so that they're going to seal up the eastern gate because God came through it. And no man can go through that gate now because God came through it. Because you're not like God and God's not like you. So here's God saying, "Your kings set up their threshold by my threshold. They set up their doorpost by my doorpost with only a wall between me and them." So God is saying, "You're just humans. I am the all omnipotent master of time, space, and reality. Let's not confuse the two. Let's not start thinking that you are in any way like me, because you're not." "And they have defiled my holy name by their abominations, which they have committed. So I have consumed them in my anger." When did God ever consume the church in his anger? When exactly did that happen? Yeah, you should all be shaking your heads loudly. Verse 9. "Then let them put away their harlotry and the corpses of their kings far away from me, and I will dwell among them forever. As for you, son of man, describe the temple to the house of Israel, that they may be ashamed of their iniquities, and let them measure the plan. So God is saying, I was specific on purpose. Now that I allowed you to know the exact measurements of the temple I intend, you make sure to tell Israel that's what I want. That's why it's recorded in the book of Ezekiel. That's why this many thousands of years later, we can still read it out of the book of Ezekiel, and it still says the same thing, because God requires this temple to be built this way for his glory, and then he promises to occupy it and be among Israel forever, to be their God, and they're going to be his people. And they're going to put away their harlotries, and he's going to dwell among them forever. So you describe the temple to the house of Israel. Why? So that they may be ashamed of their iniquities. Real interesting phrase. Several different commentaries I've read about that phrase, but the essence of it seems to be that God is saying, when they see my faithfulness, when they see my glory in the temple among them, they are going to recognize that I've been nothing but good and faithful to them, and they've been nothing but rebellious toward me. And they're going to be ashamed of their faithlessness once they recognize the God they're dealing with. So tell them about it. Describe the temple to the house of Israel, that they may be ashamed of their iniquities, and let them measure the plan. And if they are ashamed of all that they have done, make known to them the design of the house, its structure, its exits, its entrances, all its designs, all its statutes, and all its laws, and write it in their sight, so that they may observe its whole design and all its statutes and do them. This is the law of the house. Its entire area on the top of the mountain, all around, shall be most holy. And behold, this is the law of the house. Next week, we'll start at verse 13, and we'll begin to read the altar of sacrifice. And God is going to be just as specific yet again in describing all the particular sacrifices and offerings that he expects from them. And then we're going to get to the gate again. The gate is going to be sealed in chapter 44. The gate of the east cannot be entered by any man because God went through that gate, but there is a man who's going to enter by that gate. After God gets done saying, no man can enter by that gate, seal that gate, God went through that gate, there's one man that enters through that gate. The prince gets to enter through the gate. You know who that is? That's the Prince of Israel. Yeah, that's the one who's going to rule and reign from Jerusalem. He gets to enter the gate that only God can enter. What does that tell you? He himself is God.
Amen.
Amen. Questions about that portion?
More like this temple, which appears to be built during the millennial kingdom, with a statement in Revelation 21 where John says, I saw no temple in the city.
Yeah.
Which comes out of heaven after
the
millennial kingdom. What happens to this temple?
You tell me.
That he said he was going to dwell in forever.
You know, there are folks who say, because Paul says we are the temple of God, that there's no need for that temple. That's one of the ways that people argue against the future temple. My argument from beginning to end has been, there are missing details. I'd love to know. After the 1,000 years, where does that temple go? In the New Jerusalem, you're right, there's no temple. So where does that temple go? God's still going to dwell with Israel forever. Those missing details, though, can't be a reason for us to say, well, then the rest isn't true. Mm-hmm. All we can say is that God, who's a God of his word, said, I'm going to be with you forever. And importantly, his history with Israel is that he's never abandoned them. From the time that he chose Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, from that time forward, he's been nothing but faithful in his commitment to Israel. And it's going to continue into the millennium and into New Jerusalem, which you mentioned, chapter 21 of Revelation, begins with the new age and the new heavens and the new earth. So chapter 20, you've got your 1,000 years, and you've got that temple, and then you've got your New Jerusalem and new heavens and new earth in chapter 21. God can be consistent to Israel through all of that and still keep his word, I'll always be with you. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Well, my theory on that was that the thunder explained what happened to this.
That's why John was told not to write what the thunder spoke. Because the thunder said, let me explain that to you. I got a lot of things to tell you.
But I do have a question.
Is there
a mention of the Ark of the Covenant in this temple?
My answer is no, I don't believe that it is. But if somebody knows differently, correct me. Because now that I'm thinking through the coming chapters, I don't think it directly is. Anything else? Yes, sir.
This temple that we're talking about, will it be built during the 1,000-year reign, or is it?
I don't know where else it fits. I believe it has to be during the 1,000-year millennium because the 1,000 years is the kingdom of Israel. And that is when Jesus is reigning from Jerusalem. And so that's the only place that it can fit.
So it's not the same one that's coming down out of heaven?
No, in chapter 21, New Jerusalem comes down out of heaven, which is so enormous and a giant cube-like structure that it dwarfs this temple. And
1,400 miles square.
Cubed. So that goes way up. And I want an apartment near the top. So,
in outer space.
Yeah.
You're going for the penthouse.
But yes, I believe this is the millennial temple we're talking about. And most commentators agree with that, that if it's a literal, genuine temple, that's the only place it can fit. Now, if you come at the Bible from a covenantal, amillennial viewpoint where you say there can't be any future millennium, then you have a real problem with that temple. And so you're almost forced to allegorize it in some way or say, well, that's the church and just move on. But if you just read what the Bible actually literally genuinely says, then there's plenty of room for that temple. Yes, sir?
Listening to all these pieces and trying to put this all together, it just kind of dawned on me on the way up here that this 1,000-year period is when Israel is continuing to offer sacrifice for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
That light bulb just never did go on until I listened to last week's sermon about it.
Can you see now why God says that he's going to create flocks and flocks of men and animals in Israel? It's going to require God to keep producing in order for there to be these sacrifices for 1,000 years. Yeah. But during that 1,000 years also, according to Revelation 20, Satan's bound so that he can't deceive the nations. And so the genuine worship of God without Satan's interference and God dealing with Israel without them having that influence on them, that's going to be a really magnificent demonstration of God's faithfulness to his covenant people.
And yet, while all this is going on, there will be those living in that millennial period who are not God's children.
Right.
As is evidence of what happens at the end.
At the end, Satan's loose for a short time, Gog and Magog, and people following.
I just keep thinking, and in fact, that was one of the things that was a really strong argument, besides a very clear statement in Revelation 20 about a 1,000-year period that is really hard to argue away, but why do we need a 1,000-year period of a perfect kingdom? Well, one argument could be that today, if you look at explanations as to why we live in such a horrible world, why do bad things happen to good people, etc., any of those things that go on, well, it's because of culture, it's because of poverty, it's because, you know, all of these things, the way you were raised, none of that will be true when the perfect king sits on his throne. There's never been a perfect government, there will be then. Mm-hmm. And still, as soon as Satan is released, people will turn from that perfect king to follow the deceiver. Mm-hmm. But they won't come anywhere near Jerusalem,
right. Which
is also fascinating.
Well, and according to Zechariah, the surrounding nations, the Gentile nations, that came up against Jerusalem during the tribulation period are going to be forced to come up year by year and keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And if they don't, God curses them. And so the Gentiles... Yes, there's plenty of reason to keep doing it. And that's 1,000 years of year after year. This is what we do. We got to go to Jerusalem because the real God of Jerusalem exists, and he'll curse us if we don't. And you can see why then when Satan goes to Gog and Magog, they're like, yeah, let's rebel against that God. Whew. There's a whole lot to be done yet. That's all I'm saying. We're just right here in the middle of it all, but there's a whole lot of stuff to happen.
The only thing I can think of it is that when God made those promises to Israel and he set them aside and picked up the Gentile, every jot and tittle had to be fulfilled. So in my mind, he's going back to complete what he said he was going to do after he's finished with us.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that he chose to work that way.
Oh, yeah. No, you've got the big overview. That is the point. That God is going back to what he meant for them to do in the first place. And rather than give up on them, aren't you glad that God didn't just say, Israel rebelled, I give up? Instead, the consistent faithfulness of God is, Israel rebels, I will restore them. That's the very essence of everything I believe and have faith in when I launch out into eternity. That God's faithfulness is going to carry me, not because of anything in me, but because that's how he is. That's good news. Did you have something else? I saw your hand go.
Yeah, I had another light bulb that I needed to turn on. It dawned on me. Christ comes back with the church. Then the millennium starts. And then all Israel has it written on their hearts. They know who it is. They know who Christ is. So Israel is continuing to go through the sacrifices in the temple. Is the church there also during that time? Are we there? Part of that?
Are we there? Yes. Ruling and reigning with Christ is the language the Bible uses. But are we participating in Israel's worship? I don't think so. Because that's specifically for Israel. The church wasn't at Mount Sinai. The church wasn't part of the old covenant. The church came about through the new covenant. So while I can certainly see that we would be serving Christ in whatever capacity he has for us to serve, but remember, just keep that distinction. Remember that what's happening in the temple in the future belongs to Israel, just the same way that the law belonged to Israel, Moses belonged to Israel, the covenant belonged to Israel, the prophets and priests belonged to Israel. They've never belonged to you. You weren't at Mount Sinai. You weren't in that covenant. You were brought in by the new covenant, salvation by grace through faith. That's your relationship with God. And that's why there's so much language in the New Testament of you as a Gentile believer in Christ not going back to the law. But Israel has never accomplished the law. They're going to be responsible for it. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. Good questions. Good conversation. Anything else?
Just think what it'll be like for people like Peter, James, and John, and Paul, who were Jews, and Paul, the apostle to the Gentiles, who was willing to sit down and fellowship with Gentiles and not worry about the law constricting them, and yet that'll be his worship.
And Jesus said to them, the 12 of them, that they are going to sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And when the new Jerusalem comes, it's on the foundations of the 12 apostles, and the 12 gates have the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. That's one of my basic arguments, is if Jesus promised 12 guys that they're going to judge the 12 tribes of Israel, don't there have to be 12 tribes of Israel someday for them to judge? Or else Jesus was just fibbing. Just making stuff up. Anything else? All right, say goodbye to the internet congregation.
Bye. Bye.
Do you guys want to say goodbye to yourselves?
See you next time. Bye, Bob.
Bye, Bob. Well done, you. Okay, good. Score one for you.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. We welcome your feedback and encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.